Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention now to neonicotinoids. More than 18 experts will speak next Wednesday at the Wisconsin Neonics Forum in Madison. And two of the speakers are with us today to talk about neonic pesticides. One is Mike Miller, stream biologist or ecologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Water Quality. Mike, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity.
Travis Schmidt is our other guest. Travis is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. And Travis, welcome. Thank you for taking some time to be with us as well.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this important subject.
As we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the threats posed by these widely used insecticides? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Mike, let me turn to you first. Next Wednesday, as I mentioned, you're both going to be giving presentations. The program for the forum says you are going to be providing an overview of neonics and the risks they pose to the environment. So let's do a little. What are neonic pesticides?
Sure. Thanks, Larry. So most of you realize that plants like tobacco produce nicotine, and other plants as well, like potatoes and tomatoes, they produce nicotine to ward off insect pests. So in essence, what neonicotinoid insecticides are a synthetic version of nicotine. And again, the goal is it's an insecticide to, again, ward off insect pests in our crop fields.
And how do they affect, how do neonics affect insects?
Sure. Again, they work on the central nervous system of insects and some other animals, so they disrupt communication between muscles and tissues and the brain itself.
And let me turn to Travis for a minute as well. How do neonics wind up in surface and groundwater?
Oh, well, they're applied for a variety of reasons. Crops is one of them. They're also applied on buildings and on pets to try to deal with pests in all those situations. And they're very soluble, so they dissolve in water and eventually make their way into streams and rivers and lakes and groundwater.
Yeah, and they don't just kill the harmful insects or the ones that people don't want. Mike?
Thank you. Yeah. Again, so we refer to them as broad-spectrum pesticides, where, again, they're extremely toxic to insect pests, and that's great. But, again, they don't discriminate between pests and, you know, very valuable insects.
Yeah, for sure. David in Mercer, Minocqua area, has a comment. Let's go there. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I live in an area of northern Wisconsin, the Mercer Minocqua area, and over the last 2 years, I've noticed that there's a very marked reduction in bumblebees on my patio flowers. And I was wondering, this is in an agricultural area, and could there be another cause explaining why the bumblebees are no longer coming along like they used to?
Again, certainly if it is a pesticide or insecticide problem, again, there's a number of different uses for these pesticides, insecticides, as Travis had mentioned. And again, one of them is people apply them to their yards to control mosquitoes. And there's other applications around the household, again, as far as for your ornamental plants and, again, other applications. So, again, it's not just an agricultural chemical, but it's used for a wide variety of different applications.
Yeah. Comment, Travis?
Yeah, people even put them on their pets. I mean, when you're trying to get rid of fleas on your pets, you're sometimes using fipronil or imidacloprid.
Yeah. So, and this could lead to, obviously, and it has probably led to a reduction in our insect populations.
Right. And I'll defer to Travis on this. This is one of his areas of expertise.
Yeah, Travis?
Yeah, so I've been involved with trying to understand how pesticides and insecticides specifically have impacted stream insects all over the country.
Our Chris in Adams has something that I think relates to this. Chris, hi.
Hi. I have a little balcony. It's the only garden I have, and I buy between $300 and $600 worth of plants every year to put out there. And so last winter we pulled everything in the house and I overwintered them, and that was more or less successful. So I put them back up for the summer and I brought them back in the house, and I've got them in the house now with grow lights. And I'm wondering if the neonicotinoids reduce in strength over periods of time like that.
Oh, so do they lose potency so they're less harmful to insects?
So I'll feel that. So one, they're relatively long-lived. They can last in the soil for tens of years, but they do break down over time. They break down more rapidly in, say, an aquatic environment in the water column. But again, they would break down. And it should be noted that some home stores, they pre-treat their plants that you buy in the store with neonics. And some of these stores have actually discontinued the use or the practice of pre-treating house plants with these chemicals.
Oh, interesting. Chris, thank you so much for calling. And Tom in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I have a question. I do research up in northern Wisconsin in a forested area for the last 50 years, and the butterfly populations have crashed. I mean, totally crashed. We're down to probably 15-20% of what we had just 6-7 years ago, and there's been no spraying, nothing done up there. And my question is, having worked on PCBs on Green Bay, are you sampling rainwater? Does this stuff, is water soluble? It's in the water. Does it evaporate up, and can it be deposited elsewhere? PCBs on Green Bay on a nice day like today that's sunny and bright and windy actually becomes a source of PCBs rather than a sink. And, you know, and that's the question. Is this stuff atmospheric?
Yeah. For the limited amount of monitoring we've done in the state of Wisconsin, we are finding these and other neonics and other pesticides in our surface waters in the forested north. So again, that suggests that there's atmospheric transport of these chemicals.
Yeah, Travis, anything to add there?
I'm less aware of that, but I do know that imidacloprid is often used as an injection around trees to try to control infestations in trees in people's yards, and sometimes by the management land use agencies as a way to mitigate a pest around places like campsites and stuff like that.
Tom, thanks. Mary Kay in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. First of all, they should be posting what they're using on the properties, okay? Second of all, we need to go back to natural predators and more vinegars, something that's safer.
Just one, to me, interesting anecdote on that is that there's been a few studies that show that when in agricultural applications of neonics, it actually, in addition to reducing some of the pests, it also reduces some of the natural predators of these pest insect species, and actually promotes some pest outbreaks by, again, killing the native predators. So, again, your concerns are well-founded.
And the another interesting thing, and I think I saw it in something that one of you may have written, a lot of the neonicotinoid use in agriculture comes right in the seeds themselves, like corn seed, for, you know, you're planting these seeds, and they are infused with neonicotinoids, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, and I'll touch on it briefly, and Travis can follow up. But yes, again, as Travis mentioned earlier, there's numerous applications of these chemicals across the U.S. and the globe, for that matter. In Wisconsin, there's over 500 different products licensed for use in the state that contain neonics. And again, as Larry just pointed out, the vast majority of these chemicals used, at least in the agricultural parts of the U.S., is on seed applications. So, again, for field corn, for example, nearly 100% of the field corn seeds sold in the U.S. are pretreated with insecticides like neonics and sometimes fungicides and other chemicals. And for soybeans, upwards of 65% of the seeds sold in the upper Midwest are treated with these chemicals prior to sale. So even if a producer, agricultural producer, wanted to not use these chemicals, it's very challenging for them to be able to purchase seed that do not have these chemicals already applied to them.
Mm. Travis, anything to add there?
Yeah, just that because it's on seeds as codes and it's on a wide variety of crops, sometimes those seeds are put in the ground like in the winter or early spring. And so now we have pesticides that are dissolving when the soils thaw and are entering the water cycle, almost year round.
If this is a problem in terms of our insects, why are we doing anything about it? Maybe this forum is a way to start addressing this, but Mike, you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. Frankly, I think relative to Europe, the Europeans have banned the use of neonics in many countries. My personal opinion is I think in the United States, we're kind of behind the times a little bit as far as understanding the impacts of these chemicals and having more intelligent management of these chemicals as well. So, I think that this forum hopefully will generate some interest. And again, there's increasing awareness across the country. There's a number of states now, maybe 6, 10, 12 states that have enacted legislation to reduce the use of these chemicals. So, there's a number of different studies. The numbers of studies are increasing rapidly showing impacts of these chemicals. So I think as awareness increases, hopefully we'll be more intelligent on how we manage these chemicals.
Yeah. So when they're in the seed, when the neonics are in the seed, I mean, it infuses the entire plant, right?
Sure. That's the strategy. But the few studies I've read suggest that about 90% of the neonics actually wash off the seeds before they're taken up by the crop plant. And again, being water soluble, they enter the soil quickly. And then, as Travis mentioned, that can be a direct pathway to our surface waters.
Yeah, our surface water. And what's the research or what research has been done on the effect on people?
Travis, do you want to
jump
that
in,
one?
Travis?
Yeah, it's outside of my area of expertise, I think is the best way to answer that. But there are some studies coming out now showing pesticide impacts on children and adults. They're pretty widespread in the environment, so we're all exposed to some level.
Sorry, Travis. I'd offer, read a recent study out of Iowa where, again, they focused on pesticide applicators in the state, but nearly all the applicators had detectable concentrations of neonics in their urine. And some studies done in Europe where they use people's hair as a kind of biomonitor of chemicals, and they found that upwards of about 30 or 40% of just the general population had neonics in their bodies. So as Travis just pointed out, they're pretty pervasive in the environment and not surprisingly showing up in humans.
Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt, our guest today, Mike, stream ecologist with the DNR of Wisconsin, Travis Schmidt, research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. And they are both speaking, and we're going to talk some more about this forum. Excuse me. They're both speaking on October 30th at the DeLuca Forum at the UW-Madison. It's a neonic forum. I think it's the first one, isn't it? Yeah, it's the very first one to address the issues surrounding neonicotinoids. You can join in with your own questions. The number 800-642-1234, or you can email us, email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the use of neonicotinoid pesticides today with our guests. There's a forum that we've been talking about to discuss it in Madison on October 30th, and we'll tell you a little more about that as well as we move along today. But there's some pretty bad effects that are showing up in a lot of research, and neonicotinoids have been banned in parts of Europe. And we're talking about the effects on our plants and our animals and our insects today with our two guests, Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt. It's great to have Mike's with the DNR in Wisconsin, and Travis, a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. So great to have both of them along. And again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Dennis in Two Rivers will give you a chance to join in.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. Well, this applies to raspberries because it's the only kind of gardening I have. The only trouble I have is with June bugs that come around now and then. So if I were to put any pesticides on them, I would wait until the June bugs come around on maybe every other year or whatever, and that would be after the pollination is done. So I just wonder, well, how many crops could that apply to? If they're just wait and see if there's going to be pests, and if there are, then maybe put the pesticides on, and maybe that's after the pollination is done.
Sure, I'd like to address that question. So for a long time, ag producers used a tactic called integrated pest management, where they would rotate crops, survey the fields to see if there were any type of pest outbreaks, and then only apply these chemicals when there was an outbreak of some significance. Now that we use these seed-applied neonics, they've kind of abandoned this integrated pest management strategy, and again, they're applying these chemicals regardless of if there's a need or not. And in brief conversations with some UW-Madison agronomists, they estimated that prior to the use of seed-applied neonics in the state of Wisconsin and elsewhere, that roughly about 5% of the corn in the state was treated with neonics. And frankly, as I understand it, as I recall, in essence, none of the soybeans were treated with neonics. And now that we're using these seed-applied routes of application, 100% of the corn, nearly 100% of the corn is being treated with neonics, and very high proportion, over 50% of the soybeans. So we're applying these chemicals kind of irrespective of whether or not there's a problem.
And, I want to bring up DDT for a minute as well, because DDT is a long banned pesticide in our country. And how toxic are neonics compared to DDT?
Travis, did you want to handle that one?
That's a good question. I'm not sure exactly, but I will note that the reason why we have neonicotinoids is in fact because we had management strategies in place to reduce our reliance on DDT, and the problems with DDT and other compounds in that group of synthetic pesticides is that they were not very specific to insects, and so they had effects on wildlife. And so, for example, we had egg thinning in birds. And so there was a want to get new pesticides so we could manage insect pests. And so neonicotinoids were developed, and they are way more specific. And so they target insects very precisely. And so they reduce risks to those wildlife now. But because they're so much more specific and insects, that we see probably more effects on non-targeted vertebrates.
Yeah.
And I'd offer one more point, and I can't cite the particular study, but the estimate I recall is that neonics are thought to be between 7,000 and 10,000 times more toxic to insects than DDT. So Travis is certainly right that DDT was problematic for birds and mammals, humans included, whereas neonics are more of a targeted towards insects in particular. But again, as mentioned earlier, not only are these chemicals very effective at killing insect pests, but again, many of the different insect species that are fundamentally important to ecosystem health.
Yeah, absolutely. Laurel in Cottage Grove, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is such a big issue. A number of years ago, I had incredible, first of all, I'm a civics and rural heritage preservation advocate. I'm native of Wisconsin, and I've lived in Tennessee for many years, but I visit all the time. I had a really interesting job for a national wholesale tree and shrub distributor that contracts with these big box stores across the nation. I was stationed at a particular Home Depot working for this provider of tree and shrubs, and I did notice every single plant that came in and tree had this little spike in it. And I read it, and it said this plant has been treated with neonicotinoid. Now, this was 5 years ago I did this job. And I thought, well, that's strange. And it said, call this number for more information. Anyway, what I came to find out, every single plant that came in, flower, during the spring season, had that very same spike. This is a major consumer issue, and the consumer has to understand and read the labels and apply pressure on a national level, certainly local, starting with your local representatives and your stores. What I had come to learn was through a lot of the work with the EWG, Environmental Working Group, and other advocacy organizations, that there is a big movement to bring awareness to this. Of course, European cultures have already dealt with it, but it's really these big box stores. What Home Depot apparently in my region, I had brought it up, and everybody started getting these plants that were treated. But I think what this really is about is industrial agriculture being embedded into our modern way of life, and that is very complicated, but this has to be a consumer issue, which I think you can talk more about. But anyway, what I understood is several big box stores did get a lot of complaints, and they Lowe's had stopped buying from retailers that were, or wholesalers that were, using neonics. Now, that was encouraging. Whole Foods, same thing. So people just need to really be involved. There's so much we can do just inside from our own home, knowing, you know, applying pressure at the level of where we shop.
As consumers. Yeah. Laurel, thanks for calling. I'll ask you both to comment on that. Mike, start with you.
Sure. Certainly the business of producing and selling neonics is a big business. There's four major producers globally, and each one of them, sales are upwards of about $10 billion with a B dollars annually. So it's a big business. And kind of curiously enough, the Bayer chemical company out of Germany, those chemicals are banned for use in Germany, but they still export them to the U.S. and a number of other countries. So, you know, it's a big business, presumably very profitable. So not surprisingly, those entities are going to be reluctant to kind of reduce their sales of those chemicals.
Yeah. Travis?
Yeah, there's been a transition in how we use pesticides, and we once used a more judicious application for when we had problems, and now we use them to prevent problems.
Yeah, yeah. Tim in Oregon, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in a very natural place, Hook Lake Bog. I'm in the middle of it. I've noticed a precipitously drop in insects that's off the charts. We used to have tons of, lightning bugs or whatever, fireflies. They're all way down. I used to drive down the road and had to clean my windshield off with bugs. Not one bug this year on my windshield. The insects have gone way down, and I'm serious. There's something going on. They planted this soybean field and for the last two or three years, and they sprayed it, and the spray was at least 2 feet off the ground. I went through it with my car, and I walked through it, and I developed an earache that was so severe. I looked it up that these applicators that put this stuff on, they have 90% hearing loss. But I've seen the insects in this area, which are used to be so thick that you just have to wipe your hands away. Everything, the deer flies, the mosquitoes. I know it's a drought year, but maybe the birds, too, are eating up a lot more. But there's been a huge decline in the insect population.
Comment? Mike, I'll start with you.
Sure. There's been some studies primarily out of Europe showing pretty precipitous declines in insect populations, primarily terrestrial insects. But I think the same holds true for aquatic insects as well. And unfortunately, in the United States, we have a relatively limited amount of data to show these trends. So, again, we've got a lot of anecdotal evidence, like our caller just mentioned. Frankly, the impetus for this forum was that it's partly sponsored by the Trout Unlimited organization, and trout anglers in particular are very keen observers of nature, and they oftentimes fish the same streams year after year, take meticulous notes about what insects are hatching, how many, that sort of thing. And they've been noticing over the last few decades that they're similarly, as the caller mentioned, very dramatic declines in these insects that they'd again try to match with their fly fishing to catch trout. So again, people on the out in the environment are some of the kind of first people to pick up on some of these population changes in insects.
Yeah, Travis, and by the way, you did a national water survey, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I've been involved in a number of national water surveys, and one of the ones most recently we did was we sampled about 500 streams across the continental U.S., and we looked at bugs and fish and algae, and we measured about more than 220 pesticide compounds in the streams, and we were just trying to ask the question, like, can we detect that pesticides in streams are related with changes in invertebrate communities? And, you know, it's a kind of a good news, bad news story. I mean, the good news is in stream ecosystems, we're not seeing these. There's a lot of headlines with the terrestrial insects, like the in insect apocalypse is upon us. And I do not see that. We do not see that in streams. But what we do see is when pesticides are high in streams, specifically neonicotinoids, we see declines in pesticides. Especially, you know, now we're in rivers, we're integrating what's happening over the entire landscape. So we see a lot of mixtures. And one of the outcomes of our studies was looking at two of the most commonly detected neonicotinoids, clothianidin and imidacloprid. Mm-hmm. And what we measured in a lab study and in the field was that when you have those two neonicotinoids in mixture, we see stronger effects on stream invertebrates than you do when you just see one of those compounds in the water.
So they kind of working together in a way to create a problem.
Yes, sir. Yep.
So I want to give kudos to Travis and his colleagues at the USGS. Frankly, they did a study back in 2013. It was called the Midwest Water Quality Assessment Study. And when I read the results of that study, that set off alarm bells in my head. And so that precipitated, frankly, the Wisconsin DNR to begin collecting data from streams as far as the concentrations of neonics. And so we did a study back in 2020 and sampled a random population of streams across the state. And based on the concentrations of neonics we were seeing in the streams and based on using laboratory toxicity data for aquatic insects, we made some estimates that upwards of about 3,000 miles of streams in Wisconsin, at least in 2022, had neonic concentrations that were sufficiently high to be acutely toxic to aquatic invertebrates, insects in particular, and then roughly about 17%, and I think that was about 7,000 miles of streams in the state probably have had at the time chronic concentrations of these neonics. So we don't have direct evidence like the USGS studies that Matt is referring to, but if we again take lab data and couple that with monitoring data, we can make some fairly intelligent estimates of what the impacts may be to Wisconsin's stream and river resources.
Yeah, yeah. It's something else. Helen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Yes, hello. Couple questions. A few of my questions have been answered. One is who makes the stuff, and then how do we know if the seeds or plants we buy has it? But two questions that I haven't heard anyone ask yet is, one, what's the effect on birds? And two, does the DNR use neonicotinoids on their, because they do a lot of property management, obviously. Do they still use neonicotinoids?
No, I'm not certain when this occurred. Roughly within the last 2 or 3 years, they've banned the use of neonics on state properties. And as far as this question is, you know, what are the impacts to birds? There's been a few studies that show that, again, when these seeds are planted, they're coated with neonics. If there happen to be some birds feeding on the residue seeds on the surface of the crop field or whatever, they, that could be detrimental, where they lose weight, the birds lose weight, and it impacts their ability to migrate, that sort of thing. But I think the major impact to the bird populations and all other insect feeding animals, whether it's bats or spiders or whatever, is that, again, this major loss in the food chain. I'll give one example. There's a mayfly species called Hexigenia. It lives in the Mississippi River and lakes and rivers with a lot of soft sediment. They live on the stream or river bottom for their as a larval stage of the insect. And there's been some recent studies done on the upper Mississippi River that shows that there's been a major decline in this particular mayfly. And they, again, these mayflies hatch out by the billions, and they're actually measured in metric tons, the number of insects hatching at any one season. And again, the researchers equated that to food for birds, and they estimated that that reduction in emergence was enough of a food source that could feed upwards of 25 million birds from when they hatched to fledging. So again, a key food source that has been lost on the upper Mississippi River. And there's been a study initiated this year with the US EPA and upper Mississippi River states to better define, you know, what's causing this major decline.
Amazing figures. Travis, comment?
Yeah, I mean, the prey bases are impacted, and some of those studies we did for the regional stream quality assessment, we actually measured how emergence of aquatic insects changed in response to increased exposures to imidacloprid and clofianidin, but the other researchers have also measured this out in the field. And this is an incredibly important process. So there's a reason why people go look for birds near water. And it's because the birds and the bats are coming there because insects that come from water are more nutritious than terrestrial insects. And so those prey items are more important to bats and birds than those that you would find crawling in a field. And so that's why they're congregating in that area. So when we get pesticides that have effects on non-target organisms, it's not only killing or adversely affecting the invertebrates in the stream, but those invertebrates complete their life cycle in the terrestrial ecosystem. And so those effects sort of cause a trophic cascade, and you start seeing these effects, these indirect effects on higher consumers like birds.
Hmm. Our guests today, as we talk neonicotinoids, Michael Miller, stream biologist with the Wisconsin DNR, Travis Schmidt with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. They're two of the speakers. There are several other speakers as well who will be presenting at this forum on Wednesday, October 30th. At the DeLuca Forum at UW-Madison's Institute for Discovery, just down the street from here, from where we're sitting right now. And, Mike, people can participate in this?
Right. I'd certainly encourage folks. I think that in-person attendance is the time to enroll for that is passed. But, again, you can certainly go online. If you just do a web search for Wisconsin Neonic Forum, you'll find a link to the forum. And again, you can certainly register to attend online, so you know, get all the opportunities of hearing all these great speakers and learn more about the topic. Again, we'll talk provide an overview of the impacts of neonics, but then we also have some experts, and you know, Travis included, to talk about how useful these chemicals are in the agricultural world and impacts to biota. And then folks will, some of the presenters will talk about what other states have done to better manage these chemicals, and you know, how can we address this concern.
So lots of causes, and how do we address this concern at that forum? That and the address, what do we type into that? We'll probably have it up on our, I'm sure we have it up on our page. But
right, if you just typed in Wisconsin Neonic Forum, it'll pop up right away.
It'll pop up right away. Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt, our guests today. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to WPR News. Taking a look at neonics on the program today and talking about the forum that's going to be addressing the issues surrounding neonicotinoids with our two guests, Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt. Lines are all full. We've got emails. Let's take a call from John in Kaukauna. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Hello. Well, I'm calling kind of late into the show, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but we took a trip last week from Kaukauna to Denver and driving around in the Rockies. And from Kaukauna to Dubuque, Iowa, we barely had any indication of insects on the windshield at all. But from Dubuque all the way through Iowa, Nebraska, and up into the Denver and the Rockies, it was a good thing we had to stop and get gas once in a while, because the windshield, dare I say, something like the good old days, was just covered with quarter and nickel size and bigger blasts of insects all over, you know, and it was hard to clean off.
Well, Mike, you want to comment?
That observation. I have some friends that are, again, avid fly fishers that live on the East Coast, and they make an annual trip to some of the western waters that are outstanding trout waters. Anyways, point is, the comments I've heard from several of these folks are very similar to what our caller just mentioned, where, again, they're driving from the East Coast, they're making multiple stops in the eastern states to, among other things, wash off their windshield, and then when they got to the Midwest, that was not a problem. And then they'd farther out into the plains, again, they're having this problem with their windshield being inundated with insects. It's an observation that a number of people have mentioned.
And, of course, the Midwest is where we got corn and soybeans. Right.
And that offer, in the bad old days, farmers, truck drivers used to take window screening and wire to the front of the radiators on their vehicles to prevent them from being from the radiators becoming plugged up with the insects. And frankly, you don't see that anymore these days. So again, lots of anecdotal evidence, but unfortunately not a lot of rigorous studies in the scientific realm.
Yeah. Julie in Madison has a question. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I am fortunate to live in a neighborhood that doesn't have too many people getting lawn care services. But I do see them around public buildings, and I see them in other neighborhoods. And I'm wondering, how can anyone find out if neonics are part of the spray used by commercial and residential lawn treatment companies?
May or may not be able to answer that, other than calling.
Right. I unfortunately can't answer that. Perhaps, I don't know if Travis has any suggestions.
No, sir. It's going to be, I think, dependent on where you're at, who's doing the application.
Yeah. There are some that advertise as organic, but you need to probably go a step further and say, well, what chemicals are you using, and what are the chemical makeup of the products?
Agreed.
Yeah. There you go, Julie. Margo in Menominee, your turn. Hi, Margo.
Hi, this is Margo. Just want to comment and thank you, gentlemen, for all of this respectful conversation having to do with pesticides, and your interactions with the callers is just fantastic. I want to let you know about a fiction book that actually has pesticides as part of the plot, and it just was released October 5th. and it's by Pulitzer Prize winner Louise Erdrich. And her last name is spelled E-R-D-R-I-C-H. And the name of the book is The Mighty Red. And it is about sugar beet farming in the Red River Valley of the North. And, yeah, so pesticides are in there.
There you go, Margot. Thanks for calling. Haven't seen that one yet. Haven't seen that book yet. But I guess it's just out. Appreciate it. Karen and Monona, your turn. Hi, Karen.
I have both a question and the comment, and listening to what I just heard, I'm going to go with the comment first, because we are just doing this to ourselves. I mean, I'm not personally responsible. I use spray on my yards a little bit, but the thing that most impressed me is something I heard about a month and a half ago, that we get our oxygen from all the little critters and birds and insects and whatever, still small amounts, but in total, they provide more oxygen to us as human beings to breathe than people do. So that means that if we are in Wisconsin or whatever, but it sounds an awful lot like a lot in Wisconsin, we're just impacting our breathing air.
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not certain. I don't think I have anything to add to that. I would offer that, again, of all the animals described on planet Earth right now, 1.2 million animals have been described on planet Earth, and roughly about 85% or close to a million of those animals are insects. So, you know, frankly, we're woefully ignorant about you know, the role of many of these animals in our environment. So, again, the fact that we're losing some, and again, although we know there's 1.2 million animals on the planet right now, it's estimated that there's probably closer to like 8 million. We just not cataloged them all. So, again, there's a high likelihood we're losing very important organisms that, frankly, we may not know that exist or certainly don't know their role in the environment. So I think we need to be more intelligent how we address some of these issues.
For sure. And you're nodding in agreement, Travis.
Yeah, I'm just going to emphasize that in the stream ecosystems, the biodiversity and the biomass of organisms in streams and rivers is dominated by insects and invertebrates, and that energy moves up the food chain and in sort of like a pyramid. And so when the insects get disturbed and affected, it does change how, you know, the sustenance and the food supply to everything above it.
How big of an environmental threat are neonic pesticides compared to, I don't know, habitat loss or perhaps climate change?
Sure. All those factors have been implicated as far as impacting insects. Again, certainly in the agricultural realm, sediment from crop fields flowing into our streams, it tends to blanket the stream bed, and that's really detrimental to the health of the aquatic invertebrates. And also, many of you know, we have excess nutrients in our surface waters as well. So certainly, I think there's rapidly growing evidence that these insecticides are having a very detrimental effect on our aquatic resources. But, you know, certainly recognize that it's kind of one of, you know, maybe four or five other major stressors affecting our aquatic and terrestrial resources.
Yeah.
I would just add that if you compare the rates of change and the use and the number of compounds that we're putting on the market with the rates of change that we're seeing in land use and other global change issues, some of our colleagues in the literature have done this and shown that green chemistry revolution and our use of synthetic chemicals is changing at a rate that should be considered on par with these other larger issues that we're talking about increasingly in society.
Laurel in Cottage Grove called but couldn't stay, wanted to add that consumers need to ask their local nurseries for plants not treated with neonicotinoids. The only way to pressure for less use of them. But a larger issue is still with seed corn and that is where some changes may need to be made.
Right. And I realize we have kind of limited time left here, but a fundamental issue here is that, you know, one, we certainly need pesticides to control crop pests. You know, I certainly understand that. And again, things like neonics have been very effective on certain crops like potatoes and other vegetable crops and fruit, that sort of thing. But again, in the state of Wisconsin, as an example, we plant upwards of about 5 million acres of corn each year, and soybeans somewhere around, I believe, about 2.3 or 2.5 million acres of soybeans. The University of Wisconsin-Madison agronomists did an interesting study where they found that, again, when using seed-applied neonics in soybeans, they found very little increases in crop yields associated with the use of these chemicals. Again, this study was done, led by UW-Madison, but there was 11 other kind of top-flight universities across the U.S. in primarily soybean-producing states that were participated in this study. Again, these were agronomists. They weren't ecologists or entomologists. So again, you know, the question is, what benefit are ag producers getting from these chemicals? Similarly, a study done at the Cornell University on field corn, they found similarly the same type of findings where, again, they compared fields where neonic-treated seeds were used with fields where neonic-treated seeds are not used. And there, too, they found little improvement in crop yields. And oftentimes, the yields are so negligible, it didn't even offset the cost of the chemicals themselves. So, again, we just need to kind of take a closer look at this type of information and make more intelligent choices about how we manage these chemicals.
Do you think they should be banned, neonics?
Again, as a DNR employee, I'm not to be an advocate, I guess, even though I probably have been today. but again, there's, you know, the researchers and various European countries. Again, the European Union has banned or vastly restricted the use of many of these chemicals. Again, it's occurring in a few states, and where more studies have been done, they've been banned in Canada. So, again, I think the preponderance of evidence suggests that the impacts are exceed the benefits for certain crops, again, and particularly in the use of seed-applied neonics.
But yeah,
again, it does not necessarily hold for, again, vegetable crops or fruit crops or whatever, but I think we need to take a closer look at the value of these compounds.
Yeah. Travis?
Yeah, I work for an agency where we don't advocate for policies. We use data collection and interpretation to provide information to decision makers, and so that's where our observations of the prevalence of neonicotinoids being detected in 30% of the rivers in the United States that we surveyed, and that in most of the ecoregions we saw that stream invertebrate communities were in fact negatively affected by the presence of those neonicotinoids is important information for decision makers to consider in setting policies, but by no means can I advocate for one decision or the other.
Good points. And this forum, if you really want to learn as much as there, you can probably learn about neonics, it'll be at this forum on Wednesday, October 30th at UW-Madison's Institute for Discovery. You can go online to view it. And I think a small charge, $10 or something, is all. And this is like, there must be at least a dozen people talking about this. And a big thanks to both of you for being with us today. I appreciate it, Mike and Travis. Thank you so much. And we'll hopefully have a chance to visit with you again. Appreciate it.
Very good. I certainly appreciate the opportunity.
Appreciate it very much. And I appreciate our staff as well. Clara Neipert, Joel Padnott, our directors today, our producers, and our technical director, Jeff Robbins, and Lee Rayburn, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.